Gold Shields brings true stories from law enforcement, the military, true crime authors, and first responders. Experience the dedication, danger, and emotional toll with the heroes themselves. These gripping tales of true crimes, true stories, and true heroes are all here on Gold Shields.
Hey, welcome back to Gold Shields. I'm Dan Murphy, along with my partner in crime, Tom Smith, and we are very excited once again to be with you here in Season 2. We have an exceptional guest today, one we're very, very fortunate to have on our show. But before we get into that, a little bit of housekeeping. I want to take care of some of our friends and mention some of the things that they have going on. First, as we always do, we want to give a shout out to Bone Frog Coffee, right, Tom?
Oh, yeah. The best coffee around.
And if you don't drink it already, I don't know why you don't. Tim Cruikshank, former career SEAL, started this company to give back to the SEAL community and just so happens to make the best coffee. And you're talking to a couple of cops here. We know coffee. This is good, good, really good coffee. Get it, bonefrogcoffee.com/goldshields for an extra discount. We also want to mention a couple of things I'll let Tom get into. But first, I just want to bring up, if you haven't seen it already, give yourself the hour and a half of your life to get some truth pumped into your brain. The Fall of Minneapolis by Liz Collin is one of the most exceptional documentaries you will ever watch. We all watched what happened in Minneapolis in 2020, and we saw from afar on the news the story that people wanted you to see. The Fall of Minneapolis gives you the true story, and it's not just opinion. It's all documented fact and video. Watch The Fall of Minneapolis, do yourself a favor, and get informed. Tom, who else do you want to thank this morning?
Well, one thing we want to do, I meant to do this last week. One of our good friends, Hector Delgado, again, former Navy SEAL, exceptional guy, has a new company, Frogman Retreat. And we're going to be talking a lot more about Frogman Retreat in the coming weeks with some more information. But make sure you go on frogmanretreat.com. All right, check it out. Amazing merchandise, great message. Proceeds going to Navy SEAL community and families. Exceptional. And Hector is the salt of the earth and a good friend of ours. So we're going to talk more about that as we go. And one more quick thing I wanted to do, and I meant to do this last week, and it means a little bit to me, so I wanted to take just 2 minutes to do it. All of us grew up in the age of television. And that was kind of our heroes, who we wanted to be. Who we looked up to. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have any of that. You know, it was TV and movies and sports. That was it. That was our heroes. And last week, we lost someone I grew up watching, and that was David Soul from Starsky and Hutch. And watching Starsky and Hutch growing up and wanted to be like them, you know, and then having the opportunity to become a police officer and a detective and growing up with that in my mind, I still want the car. I still want the car. You know, but, you know, that time frame that we grew up, you know, those TV shows made such an impact on us. And Starsky and Hutch certainly did it for me. And that's a personal thing. And, you know, I wanted to do it last week for David Soul, making an impact on a lot of people's lives. And I hope he's with God in heaven and looking down on all of us.
Thanks. You know, you're right. Some of the TV shows were very influential growing up. That was our main, and there was only a couple of channels, so it wasn't like today. But one more thing I want to mention today, and it would be a major loss on my part, or miss on my part, so to speak, if I didn't mention this. Certain names are iconic in the world when you think of, like, Hall of Famers like Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig, Joe DiMaggio. They get a new one there. His name is Tom Smith, and he's blushing right now. He hates this kind of stuff, but just got word the other day that Tom, my partner in crime here, is being inducted into the National Law Enforcement Officers Hall of Fame in March in Fort Worth, Texas. Congratulations, Tom. I couldn't think of anybody I'd like to see go in more. Your career has been far more than you'll ever admit. You've impacted so many lives, did so many amazing things, but I just want to give a shout out. And if you see this, don't be afraid to send the congratulations via social media to Tom. Congratulations. I look forward to inducting you. And all I can say is I'm going to do my best to embarrass you.
Oh, I know that. And I'm just real quick before we start the show, I'm humble beyond words and honored to be given this opportunity to look back on my career and you know, have it out there for the night. And no better person to induct me than you, with Megan there and Adam and a host of others that we'll get into in the coming weeks of other inductees that are going in. One very special to us that we'll bring up later on. But thank you for that, Dan, very much.
You're welcome.
And
well
enough of me. Let's get to what we got going today, Dan. Take it away.
Yeah, you know, we were lucky enough today to find somebody who is a voice for those who, if you're in law enforcement or you were or you care about anyone that was, you want leaders at a local, state, national level who are taking the fight to those who would tear down the people who protect us. This morning, we have a gentleman on who made history by becoming the first Republican to be elected to governor in the state of Maryland in many, many, many years. And he took over and he turned around a state that was in deep deficit to a point of budget surplus. He made great gains with relations between the community and police. He did so many outstanding things that he continues, to fight for what's right. And he's a voice for that. And I can't wait to welcome him. He's an author. He and his wife currently have a great podcast. And I want him to tell us about what he's working on now and his views on things. We are very excited to have former Maryland Governor Bob Ehrlich on our show this morning. Governor, welcome to Gold Shields, and thank you for giving us your time.
Tom and Dan, my pleasure. It's good to see you. And Tom, congratulations on the honor.
Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much.
And can I start skiing Hutch? Have it Hill Street Blues,
yeah.
Man. Come on.
Well, you know what? I thought of doing a whole decade thing. You know, the 70s, the 80s was definitely Hill Street Blues, without a doubt. You know, and I grew up SWAT, Beretta, Kojak, Starsky and Hutch.
Miami Vice,
yep.
Years late.
Yep, the Rookies, you know, and then NYPD Blue, obviously, was the kicker in the whole thing. So we had, you know what? I miss those days. I miss looking at the clock and going, oh, it's 8 o'clock or whatever. I gotta watch this show. I miss those days, man.
Yeah. But it was cool to be a cop. Law enforcement was cool. And well, I know we're going to talk about this in a bit, but it reflected an era. All those shows.
And then he went and ruined it with Don't Give Up on Us, Baby. I mean, come on, David. Really? Rest in peace, David, but come on.
But that was a hit.
I know.
Believe it
or
not.
I know.
That was a hit.
So was Muskrat Love.
Yeah, you know? Missed those days. Missed those days. But listen, like Dan said, echoing him, thank you so much for being here. And we have so many topics that we could talk about. So we're going to, you know what? We do this all the time with our guests. Take it away, Governor.
Yeah.
what's a pressing issue now? What's getting under your skin? What's getting you fired up? What?
We don't have enough time.
We got all the time we want. This is our show. This is the best part about having your own show. But what is it like? What are you watching today that is really hitting you?
What's hitting me is, well, geez, that's such a multifaceted question. For someone who has been a fan of speech, free speech, First Amendment, written about it, talked about it, given speeches about it, the whole nine yards, lived it as a politician. We talked off air about inflection points. We talked about major cultural events that occur that impact other things, that impact perception of police, for example. We'll get into that in a bit, but unbeknownst to a lot of parents, unbeknownst to a lot of Americans, a couple decades ago, there's a movement started in colleges and universities, and it was a movement to curtail speech. And the most fascinating part about this whole issue, of course, was the momentum was provided by the left. by the folks who in the 60s were associated with speech and dissent. And the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, the women's movement, all the movements of that era. And suddenly, in the new millennium, speech codes and microaggressions and safe spaces and all these constructs that came about from college campuses, all intended to limit speech. And now you have the three university presidents and the testimony in Congress. And my point is this, this may be now a new inflection point when it comes to speech and a positive in this respect. Maybe we're going to get back to what really used to define us and still should define us, dissent and having unpopular opinions and being able to express those opinions on campus. So as far as number one, this is an issue that near and dear to me, obviously. I've written about it. I have my sixth book coming out. It is something that far too often has gotten lost with respect to parents and alums particularly. And listen, I support higher education. I'm a working class kid who could play football and got lots of breaks. So I'm an old jock who was able to do that. So I appreciate being able to go to the schools I've gone to. But a lot of these schools have lost their way. And so when it comes to parents and particularly alums, people need to speak up, especially alums with their checkbooks. You know, colleges respond to alums with checkbooks. You can talk about congressional hearings, you can talk about the testimony, you can talk about inflection points, but the fact of it is we're not going to get true change on campus, a restoration of speech, if you will, until alums demand it. So that's number one. That's number one for me. Obviously, the election is huge. Talk about, you know, I love every politician today, especially on the left, existential, existential, existential. It's all you hear. Usually it's existential because that politician's career is on the line next election. That's why it's existential to that politician. But the fact of it is, what's on the line in November is so multifaceted. It goes far beyond policy. Goes to culture and values and the whole nine yards. So clearly, Kendall and I will be involved, lending our voice to whomever the Republican nominee is going to be. I'm an issues guy. Policy counts. Policy impacts everyone, every day, every minute. And you couldn't have a better contrast, especially if President Trump is the nominee. And I love contrast. Elections should be about contrast. Politics should be about contrast. So in this case, no more basement strategy, Joe Biden. You're going to have 4 years to compare. 4 years under Trump, 4 years under Biden. Let the chips fall where they may.
Great point.
So clearly, the campaign and what's at stake is going to take up a lot of our time. Cheap plug here. My sixth book is coming out. It's going to be about the Biden years and about, quite frankly, the dysfunction, the policy dysfunctions of the Biden years. So again, I know this is a police show, a cop show, but as far as what's on my mind, clearly, those are two major issues on my mind. Personally, I have one son trying to get signed in the new football league. He's a free agent, and my other son is the quarterback at Susquehanna University. So we are a football family. We are on the road every weekend. And so that's obviously on the personal side, but I'm really happy to do the show. I love what you guys are doing. But when you all asked me what topics yesterday, I sent back to you sort of an outline of five things that are pretty, at least four of these issues are pretty clear: crime in the 24 campaign and progressive prosecutors and Soros prosecutors and all that, and the border, what a mess the border is, how dysfunctional that is. And being governor post 9/11, what that meant, and sort of my interaction with police agencies at different levels. But one thing I did want to mention, we talked about this off air a minute ago, was how police and the perception of law enforcement and police changes over time. And I just sat down last night and thought about the 60s. And although it wasn't police, but the riots, the Democratic Convention of 68 and And that was about police, partially at least. And then Kent State and the assassinations of RFK and Dr. King. And it was a bad time for police. It was a bad time for law enforcement. It was obviously a negative image associated with police. And obviously, beginning in 2014 with Ferguson and Freddie Gray and Floyd, the Floyd murder, all of this, and policy repercussions that have flowed from that era have resulted in a very negative perception of police, bad time to be police, recruitment problems, immunity problems. I'm sure we'll talk about that. The left trying to chisel away at police immunity. The recruitment problems are well known. Cashless bail, all these experiments the left that have failed. So sort of two very distinct eras where police were on the defensive. And then I thought about two eras where police were cool. We just talked about one, the 80s, the Reagan years. Starsky and Hutch, Hill Street Blues. How cool was it in the 90s to be in Miami with the Miami Vice? And police were cool. And the popular culture reflected that fact.
You know,
and then obviously post 9/11.
You know, you
talked about Rudy Giuliani's leadership. We talked about police, fire, the universal love, the cultural love directed to police and fire folks and EMTs post 9/11. Again, so these are different eras, and the popular culture reflects these eras. And what's interesting to me is these events are generally outside the police, but they impact police. They impact public perception of police. So I don't want to get too deep here, but I thought about this last night, so I thought I'd mention.
No, I think it's great. And, you know, there's no way to talk about police work or public safety without politics, because politics governs how that works. And it impacts it directly. And when you're a cop working the streets of anywhere in USA, whatever the policies of your mayor, your city council, your governor, whoever it is, up to the president, whatever they are going to impact what you're doing every day. And they're going to impact how the public sees you. The media plays a big part in that. And lies get sent out there, and distortions and misrepresentations of what you're allowed to do and what you can't do. And the public seems to think they know their rights when, in fact, sometimes they just don't. They think that you have no right to stop them, when in fact you're stopping them for a very valid reason. Becomes a fight, becomes an argument, blows up on the web. Cops get a bad name. All these things happen. And, you know, you mentioned some landmark situations that occurred that were inflection points of sorts, right? The Freddie Gray situation, the Michael Brown in Ferguson, George Floyd, obviously. The country blew up after that. And you know, our leaders have a role to play in these situations. They can either inflame them, or they can interject truth, rationale, calm, wait for investigations to run their course. And we've seen failures of that. And it's weak leaders who don't stand up and say, it's time to know what the truth here about what really happened before we jump to conclusions.
Yeah, I would divide the question, Dan. I would say, first of all, some leaders fall in the category you just described. They're scared. They don't care about facts. They don't care about what actually occurred. They'll go with the popular narrative, whatever that happens to be. But I think that this is the God's honest truth. I'm just telling both of you. As a 28-year-old kid elected to the Maryland legislature, assigned to the House Judiciary Committee, where police issues were part of our jurisdiction, and I represent a pretty conservative district, even in Maryland, and I was in my 20s. And I remember distinctly learning that anti-police, anti-cop, anti-law enforcement constituted good politics in some districts. And for me, that was sort of a revelation. And I grew up with Efford Zimbalist Jr. and the FBI. Come on, Sunday night, 8 o'clock. I was conservative. I am a conservative. I support law enforcement. Law enforcement supported me in my early elections, all of my elections. I mean, I was pro-cop. My grandfather walked the beat in Baltimore City. So to learn that was interesting. Now, obviously, I didn't evolve. I mean, my views haven't changed, but what I learned as an early 20s legislator, early in my political career, has evolved now into a force, a negative force, a force that really took hold between 2014 and 2021, and still is around, obviously, on the Democratic left. It's anti-cop, it's anti-institution, it's cashless bail, it's let's take pictures of police so they can't do their job. It's everything you all know and lived with. So I do think crime and police and law enforcement, and especially in the context of the border, is going to be a major issue in this campaign. Because running over the border, what is that? That's illegal. It's criminal. it's supposed to be against the law.
Yeah, it is. That gets forgotten. That gets forgotten.
It still is.
Yeah, people forget that. Politicians forget that. So I would just say, going back to the original point, for some politicians, it's just fear. They were scared. But for folks on the left, this is what they believe. They don't particularly like beliefs. Don't particularly trust beliefs. They want to really attack the institution of law enforcement. The whole thing about replacing police with social workers, the whole nine yards. I mean, folks on the uber left, progressive left, this is what they believe. And they win election. And their views are reflected in state legislatures and in Congress. So you talk about culture and law enforcement and image and things that really impact people. The advent of service prosecutors and this old mindset, this anti-police mindset, has made our streets more dangerous, made our cities more dangerous.
Absolutely. You know, how many big cities do we see it, right, Tom? We talk about this all the time. If you allow a certain threshold of crime to take place and it's okay, I think we mentioned this before, it becomes the new norm. And the new, if you're okay with it, you'll allow it to continue. And apparently in places like Manhattan,
Portland, Seattle, San Francisco,
it's okay to sell drugs on the street for personal use because it's not, then, and the leaders will tell you, we're going after the big guys. Well, you're not. You're allowing them to flourish. And you're allowing the streets to disintegrate.
And Dan, why is that happening? Because you've elected a Soros prosecutor. You've elected a progressive prosecutor. And to be fair, that was their platform, and they won. So the people are getting exactly what
you get what you vote for, right? And there's absolutely no neighborhood.
And I think at some point, and I think this election will, I think, tell the tale of it. It's great to have your policy and to completely destroy cities, but I think at some point, even the most left person understands that them, their children, their families are at risk. And I think that reality at some point sets it. And I'm hoping that's what's going on. You know, that people stop. I mentioned this before the show. People stop just voting on what letters at the end of someone's name. And start actually listening to what some of these people are saying and how dangerous their policies are to just everyday life. And I think hopefully that takes over and makes an impact on this election, because crime, and like you said, Governor, the border is the number one thing.
Mm-hmm. We've got millions of people running around this country illegally who are felons in and of the crime of coming into this country illegally, who are now taking our resources, who are all over our streets with no purpose except to survive. And they're finding their way into gangs if they weren't already. We have terror watch list people by the scores, by the hundreds, getting caught coming across. Who knows how many we haven't found. This is scary stuff. We can't support millions and millions of people who want to come here and eke out a living any way they can, up to and including crime, rape, robbery. I'm not debasing the decent people who search for a better life, because living in Mexico in some places can be intolerable. But we as a country have to maintain our sovereignty. If we don't have borders, we don't have a country. And we've allowed the border at the South to become a joke.
Yeah, and if you dislike the country, if you think the country is inherently evil, if you think the institutions associated with that country are evil, this is okay. I mean, if it wasn't okay with a lot of people in Washington, they would have done something about it. We talked about this off the air again. Things only change when enough people care about it if they want. So when things are dysfunctional, like cities, the border, marriages, relationships, athletic teams, businesses, police agencies, you name it. When things are dysfunctional in life, people fall into two categories. They're okay. They may talk a different game, but they're okay with it. They're just, it's not important enough to them. Or again, when you reach that inflection point, enough people care, Seattle changes, Portland changes, New York goes back to Giuliani era, whatever it is. That general rule applies to everything in life, any organization. So, Tom, I hope you're right. I hope you're right. The midterms did not make me more optimistic, but I hope you're right. I hope enough blue parents listen. In Virginia, a Republican governor, Glenn Youngkin, was elected not because Republicans, he was about to lose that race. Every Republican in the state was voting for him. He was going to lose that race. It was enough blue parents in the inner suburbs who said, you know what? We're liberal. We don't like Trump, but this is a bridge too far. This is my kid. This is my local PTA. I have standing here. This is a bridge too far for me. So what did he do? They elected a Republican who was about to lose until enough blue parents said, your point, Tom, enough blue parents said, hey, enough. Enough. Sorry. There's a bright line here. My kid. Not your kid. My kid.
Well, they push.
So
the left pushes.
Yeah. Yeah. So I keep referring to this term, but I've been using it a lot these days. I think the huge issue for your show going forward, for my podcast, for everyone who cares about this country is, has the last 4 years, is the border an inflection point? Is the people who think that, no, they're our kids, not your kid, I get to show porn to your second grader. Sorry, not your call. Right. No, no, we're not going to have speech on campus. You know, that's a microaggression. Sorry. You know, all these issues are coming together. Do we want a border? Do we want a sovereignty? Do we want cashless bail? Do we care about poor people in our major cities who are now more at risk? All these issues are coming together. Is this an inflection point? I don't know. I mean, if you look at the polls these days, maybe. And it's not Republicans and not conservatives. They've had it from the jump. Are enough blue voters saying, yikes, enough, enough. This progressive stuff, not working, failing.
And you know, all you have to do is go online for 5 minutes and go in and Google PTA meetings, contentious PTA meetings or something, and you'll see parents livid over the stuff that's going on in the school system. The books that are being allowed to be taught to their children are beyond pornographic. They're disgusting, reprehensible, and they're polluting the minds of small, unformed brains, and they're telling kids it's okay to not feel like you're a boy or a girl, and we'll help you, and we'll give you hormones, and we won't tell your parents. I mean, this is, I hate to say, but communist China? I mean, the type of stuff we expect from there, where the kids are told to report on the parents if the parents, you know, don't praise the chairman at home over dinner. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that happened during COVID, too, which was the whole report on your parents if they're allowing a gathering of 25 people in your home.
And COVID was the cover, but the fact of it is these folks believe this stuff. I used four examples. Dan used to use another one. These used to be bright lines. Criminals banned.
Yeah.
Criminals banned. It's my kid. There's a border. My daughter gets to compete against girl. These used to be pretty bright lines out there. So this is a pretty important election. All these bottom lines, all these bright lines are now at risk, at issue. And I just hope people vote on merit, not personality. we've seen what the president's going to do. I mean, it's play one from the play from their playbook. It worked last time, and it worked in the midterms. Trump bad, abortion, Trump bad, abortion, Trump bad, abortion. That's the playbook. Oh, and throw white supremacy in and all the race stuff, too. And that's the playbook. And we'll see if it works again. It worked 2 years ago.
You know, much has been made about the abortion issue, and there's a lot of people saying that the overturning of Roe versus Wade was the worst thing that any Republican-led Supreme Court could have done, when in fact, and nobody wants to hear the facts, we know that, but when in fact, by law, by Constitution, anything that is not relegated to the federal government is therefore in the hands of the state, and there was no specific constitutional right or ownership of laws concerning abortion. It's a state's right. And so it went back to the states. The federal government did not outlaw abortion, although the media would have you think that. The federal government, the Supreme Court did not say abortion is illegal in America. The Supreme Court said to the 50 states, you guys decide on this because it is not a federal law. It is not a federally decided law. And it's only a proper constitutional decision. Yet they'd have you think that Republicans want to run around and they want to force victims of rape and incest to have babies, and they want to you know, shut down, arrest people for having. They would have you think crazy things to get you to think what they want you to think. But it was really a simple ruling, wasn't it? It was just righting a wrong.
It's perception. Your explanation, your 1 minute explanation there, wholly accurate, and in that respect, not very radical in that decision. But politics is about perception. We're talking about police, perception. We're talking about the issue of abortion, perception. The modern left knows how to drive messages about abortion, and they do it really well. And they do it far better than Republicans. What you just said is accurate, but gets lost with the emotionalism attached to the issue. So, you know, again, it's a three-pronged playbook. The president's been very clear. They can't win on contrast. If you're going to compare these two terms, the average person who doesn't pay much attention to politics is going to say, I kind of like the way it used to be. I kind of liked when I took my family out to dinner, I could afford the tab. I kind of liked it when my local school system was more responsive to me. Kind of liked it when we had a border. I kind of liked it when our cities were on the upswing. So we'll see. I hope people get tired of race politics at some point. It will continue to be part of the playbook until it doesn't work anymore. I hope people get tired of this uber progressive attack on our values and our institutions. And I hope people don't vote on the basis of personality. They know the president is a polarizing personality. They ran against his personality the last two times. It worked. We'll see if it works again.
Yep. Now, I got your question. Where, like, we talked about perception of the police and things going on in this country. Where, and we talked about, like, the 70s and 80s and being, you know, being a cop was popular and cool and all that. Do you think there was a point in time, or when do you think that point in time that things changed? What was it that went, wow, superstars, kind of celebrities take pictures with cops on the corner, to, nah, not into it? Like, there was a time, and Dan and I, we've had, you know, other guests that we've tried to nail this down too. We were actually one time on a show and got asked that. And both me and you had two different answers. Because it's like you said, a perception. But I'm curious on your thought. Where do you think it broke apart?
I think it's where the culture is, and where the culture is partly a function of these major events. If you combine Ferguson, Freddie Gray, and Floyd, that's an era, and I peg that era from 2014 to today. And these events occurred, and once so long ago, police shows were being taken off the air on cable. Cops, remember, was removed from the air. So events impact perceptions of police and law enforcement. I believe, again, during Reagan, the conservative era, after Vietnam, after the protests, people were, it was sort of the, going back to the 50s, maybe the, I wasn't around, but the Eisenhower era, people wanted to, enough of the upheaval, enough, at that time it was enough of World War. Reagan, it was enough of the 70s, enough of inflation, enough of riots, enough of, whole nine yards. So it was an era of more conservative values, more respect for police. So, Tom, I think the answer is, again, it's major events that occur, 9/11. Post 9/11, police could do no wrong. George Bush in Yankee Stadium. All the professional teams wearing New York police, New York fire. Right? So all these events impact. And sometimes, look, in 68, there was the so-called police riot and all that, if I recall my history correctly, and all the civil unrest, and it was a bad time for police. So that was actually big police involved. And but some of these events aren't. 9/11 was about terror and death. But what came out of it was, maybe we should respect these people who went into those buildings for us. So events outside the police impact the perception of police, period. And again, I just last night just came up with these two examples on sort of errors that were negative with respect to police and errors that were positive with respect to police. And no surprise, we talked about the TV shows, the modern culture, Hollywood picks up on it. Police are hot. Okay. Miami Vice, man, these are cool cops. Right? So we'll see. And I guess the whole bottom line to our conversation today, and what you guys talk about, what everybody talks about leading up to the election is, will 24 be that next inflection point? Will enough people say, enough of this experiment, cashless bail? Well, don't judges really do that? I mean, where was the problem here? Is this a solution in search of a problem? Is this really, do we really want to make our streets more unsafe? Listen, if you Google me, criminal justice reform was part of my legacy as governor. We were doing it before it was cool. I was looking at old cases. We were providing resources behind bars and drug treatment and employment opportunities. And I was given pardons and commutations on some really tough cases because I thought that's where the merits were. So we were doing this stuff. But President Bush, President Trump signed a major criminal justice reform law as well. So what was right and justice laden has now evolved into just open the doors. Open the doors, cashless bail. And as a result, poor people are more unsafe because they can't move. As a result, San Francisco is what San Francisco has become. And a lot of these cities, your city.
It's a shame.
So
it's a shame.
Is this an inflection point? Are enough people going to say enough? We'll see.
We certainly hope so. I mean, we know that the men and women of law enforcement of this country at every level are ready and eager to do their jobs. We know they love doing their jobs. They serve their communities with pride. They need the leadership that backs them, that provides the direction and charts the course for them to be successful, and bridges the gap with the community by properly explaining things to them. Not lying to them about what a cop did or didn't do, but telling them the truth, educating them on this is why this is done. This is why it's proper police procedure to do this, so that public understands, and they need that sort of support.
But Dan, you mentioned the impact of politics and police. When the average person sees, the FBI these days and the Justice Department and the politicization of the Justice Department, it doesn't help respect for law enforcement, does it?
Not at all.
So and you and I, we've seen the whistleblowers, we've seen the FBI agents come forward, we've seen, again, going back to, we keep talking about TV, Sunday night, 8 o'clock, Efren Zimbalist is the FBI. Never missed in the early council. Never missed. That's the FBI I grew up with. And now, Google FBI today. And that impacts perception. Yeah, the whole fight over where the FBI headquarters is going to be, Republicans in Congress say, you'll get a new headquarters. Not with this type of stuff going on. So, again, politics plays a huge part.
I think that's a very, very important point to touch on. It's something that's happening that Tom and I both are very saddened and shocked over, to see the weaponization of the Department of Justice and the FBI. I spent some time working with the FBI and task forces. Tom spent the bulk of his career in the terrorism task force with the FBI. And he's had many experiences, many he can't talk about, but it's just not what people think it is. It has really devolved into a political arm of the Democratic Party in so many ways, at least at the leadership level. And this is not to take away from the good, hardworking street agents around the country. There are many, many. And I don't want to be mistaken for that. But I think at the leadership at the top and at the Washington, D.C. level and the national field office, there's problems here. Tom, you could talk with more about some of the things you've seen if you're able and willing. But it's people, public need to know that that agency needs to be turned around.
Totally agree. And I've said this a lot, that politics ruins certain entities when they get involved in it. Education, the medical field, policing. When politics gets involved in those areas, nothing ever comes out right. Never does. I mean, look at history. You know, when politics enters those realms, things don't run the way they should. And people can't do their jobs the right way on any level. In education, medical field,
military.
Policing. Because politics run what's going on. And policies change. And that, I agree, and I said this, the reason you're watching so many videos of so many cops getting hurt is because of that. They are terrified that they're going to get in trouble. And they're allowing themselves to get beat to a pulp just so they don't get in trouble. Now, Dan, you say it all the time, and you just said it. That's a leadership problem, which I fully agree with. But it's a political problem as well. When politics gets involved in law enforcement, cops get hurt. Bottom line, hard stop.
And you said hard stop, but I'll just put a semicolon on it. And when beating up cops is good politics, cops get beat up.
And nobody wants to become a cop, which is what we're seeing in this country right now.
Well, the recruitment issue is you both know better than I do, but I can look at the numbers. And I talk to my former police chiefs about it all the time. You're a young person, or folks, let's face it, you both know very well. The great recruitment drive is usually focused on former military. Folks come out of the military, go to law enforcement. And increasingly, it's not happened. Why? Tom, what you just said. It's perception and reality. And unfortunately, the reality these days is a politicized Department of Justice. And look, that's the toughest job in the world. Attorney General. And doesn't matter what party, doesn't matter what era. We understand what kind of job that is. It is a tough job. But when the average person out there no longer holds the FBI or the state police in high regard, we got a cultural problem.
And the FBI historically had a public relations machine built under J. Edgar Hoover that could rival anybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were on. They had the best public relations, and they far exceeded their own abilities with their public relations. The public's picture of them was far above what they actually could do. But they created, they paved the path for people to have long-term institutional and societal respect for the FBI. And now that's being thrown away every day with both hands.
At the same time, the world's been never more dangerous. At the same time, we don't have a border. At the same time, we need the FBI being excellent more than ever. We need local police. We talk, one of the issues I sent you both yesterday was being governor after 9/11. You know, people forget who showed up first at the Pentagon? It was the local fire department. If 9/11 reminded us of anything with regard to law enforcement, it was a reminder that locals play a hugely important part when it comes to public safety and law enforcement. So what I saw develop, and especially in my purview then, I mean, I would get literally a daily briefing from my superintendent of state police and from the Pentagon as the governor. What were the feds doing talking to me? Well, one day the FBI called me up, Tom, very late at night. When the FBI calls you late at night, it's not to check in on your kids. How are you doing? It was they were surveilling four guys, and they lost track of them, and they thought they might be coming to blow up the Harbor Tunnel in Maryland. I closed the Harbor Tunnel the next day for a period of time. Who closed it? Local law enforcement. So the interaction, interoperability, all these issues that and problems of communication between local and federal police agencies, all this came to light after 9/11, and it improved. But it was very interesting to me to see at the time, the feds can't be everywhere all the time. It's local law enforcement still on the front lines.
You know, that's what makes up these task forces that are out there, you know, and being involved in it, Danny, as well. You know, it's not just people have this perception of the Joint Terrorism Task Force as the FBI and the NYPD, and that's it. There are 70, you know, when I left, I think it was actually 62 around there, different agencies, not federal agencies, two cops from an upstate town. You know, two cops from a sheriff's office, you know, three investigators from a DA's office. They all made up this federal task force because the outreach of those people and their resources are unmeasurable sometimes that are better than the federal apparatus. And that's why task forces of that magnitude work. And exactly what you said, Governor, you know, the local guys in the small towns and all that hear just as much stuff as the big boys.
Actually, they know more about what's going on locally than the big boys. So they are an integral part. And the group that I put together after 9/11 in Maryland reflected that, as every governor did at the time. But especially a place like Maryland, all the federal assets, all the federal venues that we have in our state. And I think it was Code Orange at the time. If we were at Code Orange, believe me, my day was focused on public safety every day.
Didn't you start the Homeland Security, state-level Homeland Security from Maryland?
Yeah. So we did some really innovative things. So I think as a former member of Congress, my experience there in dealing with the FBI and the military and all that really helped in that regard. I brought some staff over from Washington when I became governor. So we had some really experienced people help us in that regard. But my interactions with the FBI, with the feds at the time, were just excellent people, excellent at their jobs. It was a very positive
experience. Yeah, like I said before, any comments we make about the FBI and the DOJ is about the organizations themselves at the highest levels and the directions they're taking. It's not a reflection of what we have felt, and we have met and worked with many exceptional people in those agencies who are dedicated, committed, and are working around the world to protect us. So we're not taking away from them. Please, we're supporting them. We want to see their agency better.
Well, you see the whistleblowers. They want to support their agency too. They want these agencies to get back to their mandates. I want Border Patrol. We talk about, can you imagine being a member of Border Patrol these days? You're caught between Governor Abbott. You're caught between Governor Abbott trying. Think about all this, you guys. It's mind-blowing. The federal government won't do its job. So a state, Texas, does its job for the federal government, and then the federal government sues the state for doing what the federal government should have done in the first place. And if you're a federal Border Patrol agent and you have a job description and you're not allowed to do your job, which is to protect this country.
Absolutely stunning.
And you're pulled off the border to do paperwork. It's stunning. I hope this is enough, besides the cost of living, trying to take your family out to dinner and fill up the tank and feed your kids, that should be number one. It's always number one. But 1A needs to be the border this time. It has to be. The spectacular chaos, the spectacular dysfunction with purpose. You know, sometimes government fails, but the motivation is many times the motivation is good. It really is. We have an idea, a program, whatever. It just failed, but
I'm glad you said that.
Good. I don't know where the good motivation, I don't know where the positive motivation is.
I'm glad you said that, Governor, about with purpose, because you're right. There's a difference between incompetence and bad intent. And the people that are at the highest levels, when I watch someone like Mayorkas testify before Congress, attempting to stonewall, pretending to be indignant that he's doing the right thing, when in reality, he is the architect of, and he's the functionary for the people that want our border to stay open. And when I see a guy like Jerry Nadler in Congress at a committee hearing openly saying that, we want them to come across, you know, their voters, it just, they don't even bother to hide it anymore.
Well, they're saying the quiet part out loud now, which is refreshing, because to the extent they're saying the quiet part out loud, let's make it an issue, okay? The voters, they now understand it's not just incompetence. It's purposeful. So let's debate that. Let's talk about fentanyl. Let's talk about the sex trafficking. Let's talk about the impairment of property rights for American citizens on that border. Let's talk about the dislodgement of local labor markets for marginal American workers who now can't find work because they're being taken, these jobs are being taken by migrants. There are so many issues that impact. Let's talk about sovereignty in the United States of America, what it means to be a citizen. All of these issues are relevant to the border. And we're talking about respect for law enforcement. Law enforcement taking a huge hit here. Border Patrol's caught in the middle. They wouldn't do their job. My friends have gone down to that border. Yeah, the frustration from Border Patrol expressed to visitors is real. They want to do their job. They want to protect the country. So, man, I hope this is issue 1A.
I agree with you. I hope it is too. Tom and I both have very strong opinions of this. You know, one of the things, if you watch what's going on, and I had the opportunity to work with the DEA and the task force for 3 years, and it was a great experience, and you get some insight into, and this is a while ago, but the gathering storm in Mexico, Mexico as a country is in bad shape in many ways, but the cartels run that country. And the cartels that are moving the drugs, whether it be fentanyl or South American heroin or cocaine, whatever, I mean, whatever they're moving across the border is crushing and killing our country. But they're also, they don't do it in a nice, quiet way. They're being bold and upfront, and they have no problem killing U.S. federal officials or state local officials and, you know, Border Patrol, no problem. No problem wielding violence. No problem. The rise in kidnappings and homicides in border states is no, it's not disassociated. It's all together. All this violence comes in together, and we're welcoming it in with open arms. And if you're a cop in that area, a Border Patrol agent, or even just a person like you just mentioned, a landowner, ranch owners in Texas are seeing heavily armed cartel members walking across their property like they own it. And, you know, it's insane.
Well, can I just throw in there? I talked to some sheriffs, local sheriffs have gone down there. This is sort of even a micro issue. The environment. The left talks about the environment and green and all. These cartels leave trash all over these farms. The cattle eats these the stuff that they leave. The cattle die because of all the trash left by the cartels and all these folks. Nobody even talks about that. Nobody even talks about you're an American citizen living on or near the border. You can't enjoy your own property. Where do you go for relief? Yeah. I mean, you're impairing liberty interests of American citizens. And no one talks about what I mentioned earlier. Talk about marginal American labor. Folks who are generally unskilled that need unskilled jobs. They're being displaced. Nobody talks about that. There are so many aspects of this. We focus on the sex trafficking, which is horrific. We talk about the cartels, the drugs, and the fentanyl, we can measure that. We can measure those results. But how can you measure the loss of one's enjoyment of one's own property simply as a function of venue and the fact that the federal government doesn't want to do its job and protect you?
And you hope, you know, like you said, how do you know? You hope enough people talk, you know, and it gets covered. That's all we can do. And that's the sad part. You know, it's a lot of hoping. It's a lot of hoping people do their jobs and hopefully it gets reported the right way. I mean, there's enough people out there complaining about it whose lives have drastically changed. You know, these border towns, like you just said, Bob, you know, their lives change. And you hope it just gets reported enough that it gets filtered out, that enough people realize that this is not a one state problem. This is not one area of one state problem. It is a nationwide problem because it is filtering everywhere. Everyone's being affected by this. And hopefully, you know, that tide changes.
Well, every state's a border state now. And that's a reality. Every state is a border state. And although Texas and Arizona and California are being hit, you know, really hard, but every state's a border state. But, you know, Tom, you brought out a good point, hoping that it gets reported correctly. And I think that goes to the heart of another part of the playbook of those who would look to dismantle our country. And that is the censorship piece. When you are being censored, what you're being allowed to see is censored. You might as well live in rural China with state-run media. And that's why platforms like podcasts, talk radio, YouTube videos, etc., are so important, and we can't have these censored as well. People need to have a voice, and people need to hear what's going on. And Tom and I are big proponents of that, and we told each other when we first started this podcast, we will not allow somebody to come on here and knowingly spread falsehoods. We're not going to do that. We would shut them down. We wouldn't put the show on. I just don't believe in that. And it's not just my opinion. We check things out. We're not saying if you don't say what we believe, we're not going to put you on. We're saying just say the truth. If it's ugly, it's unvarnished, I don't care. If it's the truth, we want to be a platform for that. So our media is part of this failure.
Well, the media is part of the failure, but from what we know now, from the Twitter files and Facebook and all this, is that to some extent, the social media platforms, there was actually pushback. But the government came in and said, no, you will cooperate with us, Dan. That's what's really the most disturbing about this. Hey, there was pushback from Twitter and Facebook saying, we're not going to do this. And the government, no, you will do this. You will be part of our censorship enterprise. And so when you see the Missouri versus Biden, or Biden versus Missouri, I forget what, that case, you saw the federal judge for the first time. I mean, it's a pretty important case. Enough of the censorship, enough misinformation, whole nine yards, enough of this very dangerous interaction between government and media when it comes to speech. So that's why I mentioned speech as my first issue, because there's so many consequences of what's been going on in this country over the past, particularly 2 decades, but it began on campus. Don't forget that. It began, these constructs were invented on campus. And that's where the fight needs to be. So shameless plug, 6th book coming out. It's really not a book. My first 5 were books. This is a reference guide. 101 ways Maryland won. Maryland too, but America won from Sweet Land of Liberty to
Weak,
Woke, and Wobbly. A reference guide to the Biden years. It's basically 102 reasons. I see 101, but I threw another one in at the end. 102, and that people come up to me and say, only 102? Only 102 policy failures, Joe Biden? So, well, you know, come on. This is, and I mentioned this book, one, as a shameless plug, but secondly, I want to make a point to you. You two are really, law enforcement professionals. It's been your life. Thank you for your service. Very much appreciated. I've known many people like you my entire professional life, my entire adult life. I said my granddad walked the beat in Baltimore City. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. But this is good. Now, I'm a politician, okay? Sounds like an AA meeting here, but I'm a politician. And I'm going to make an observation to you that is more sort of micro rather than macro. Because we talk about all these issues that are hugely important. They're going to impact us, our kids, our grandchildren, generations to come. But this race boils down to a couple hundred thousand people in about six states. So all these issues impact various subgroups, African-Americans, Hispanic voters, suburban women, you know, all the sort of the groups you see analyzed by all the professionals all the time. And to the extent you have a couple points of uptick in a number of these groups, Republicans are going to win the presidency. If you don't have that uptick, Democrats are going to win the presidency. And we're talking about you, the three of us could sit down right now and predict accurately basically 42, 43 states, how they're going to come out and figure out the electoral votes. And that's where we're going to be election day. Again, six to eight states in play, and really not that many people within those states are going to decide. You saw the numbers from the last two election cycles. Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Arizona, Nevada, we know the state. So to the extent the issue of the border, for example, impacts a certain amount of people in a particular state, that could be dispositive. A couple of tens of thousands of people in Pennsylvania say, enough, enough. Just like Virginia, the Yunkin example. Enough blue parents said, enough. You crossed the line. So this is the political science part of all this. We're going to have billions of dollars spent. We're going to have the ugliest race in the history of mankind. We're going to have the whole anti-Trump stuff, and then obviously the president taking the bait and doing it what he does and all that. It's going to come down to a couple hundred thousand people in six states.
Crazy.
So just to kind of bring some perspective
That's
here from the political end.
All right, so it's not a shameless plug for your book, by the way, and I would love a signed copy, and we'll exchange that for one of our outstanding challenge coins, which when you see it, you're going to say, I got a good deal here. These are the nicest.
I'm adding it to
All
my
right.
collection.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I'll be happy to read your book. I can't wait to read it, as a matter of fact. You've been an amazing guest today. I mean, we could probably go on for three. I would love to sit around with you in a bar with Tom for 6 hours and just solve the problems of the world, because pick your brain on your insight. Your experience is remarkable to us. And it sheds a light on some things. So we want to thank you first and foremost for your time, and secondly, for your service to our country as well as to your state, and your continued service by being somebody who's out there trying to help America see what America used to be and can be again, and how we need it to be if we're going to survive as a country. We're on a bad slippery slope, and we need people to wake up and realize that. And I thank you for the work that you do every day. It's invaluable. Thank you.
Well, I meant what I said. Thanks for your dedication to this country. Thanks for going in the direction of danger to protect us. Thanks. I always thank my police agencies. I always thank my rank and file for what they do every day. I mean it. And we tried to show it too. I also enjoyed very much the podcast. For your folks who want to follow me, obviously we're on Twitter, but especially our podcast as well, Bottom Line, Bob and Kendall Early. You think I have strong opinions? What do you mean, Kendall Early? And she was deputy drug czar under President Trump. So she really knows the border, and she really knows the fentanyl issue, and she really knows the sex trafficking aspects of all this. So she's my co-host. Sometimes I get a word in, sometimes on the show. And that was a joke. And she's a very strong personality in her own right. You both are getting to know that. But I really enjoyed the show. Thank you for what you do. And we'll let you know. I'll take the challenge coin, and I'll send you the book. And thanks very much for having me.
Well, thank you. We will certainly update our audience on any events or anything you have going on, the release of your book, all of it. We'll update. And we plan on staying in touch with you. Thank you so much, Governor. Tom.
Godspeed.
Yep. Thank you so much, sir. It was a pleasure you being on the show. What an insightful conversation we had. We knew it was going to be. We looked forward to it, and you delivered. What a show. Thank you so much. Talk about shameless plugs. You know, towards the end of the show, we do this. Make sure you go to YouTube, facebook.com/@goldshields, rumble.com/goldshields. Hit that subscribe button, hit the bell, make sure you get notified on all our new shows coming out. We got some great ones that are already been done with Aphrodite Jones and Victor Avila. And now Bob Ehrlich is going to be out soon. And we're just getting better. So make sure you hit those, YouTube, Rumble, all our audio podcast platforms. Don't miss a show. And like we do every week, thank a law enforcement officer when you see them. Give them a wave, shake their hand, say thank you, buy them a meal if they're online at a store, wave to them on the street. They do a selfless job for nothing. And they do it for a bunch of strangers. They're out there protecting a bunch of strangers. So thank them when you see them. And as always, my big buddy, Dan Murphy, Governor Bob Ehrlich, thank you so much. Everyone out there, stay safe, and we will see you all soon.